All financial advice provided on this show is for entertainment and educational purposes only. The financial ideas and strategies discussed are only provided as a starting point for a conversation about money matters. With regard to your particular investments and financial strategies, consult your financial planner, CPA, or investment professional. All your financial decisions are yours and yours alone to make and subsequently are solely your responsibility. The information that is supplied through the context of the radio program and any repurposing of its content by the host or network is a combination and collection of solid financial investment understanding, opinion, and comments. This network, show, and its host are not liable for financial strategies, outcomes that you employ in any manner that result in any kind of loss. Shares of corporate sponsors may be the subject of buy or sell recommendations in Jay Taylor's newsletter in accordance with Jay's objective opinion.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. This hour will help investors fix issues and achieve personal gain. Now, here's your host, Jay Taylor.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm speaking to you from New York City on this, the 17th day of March, 2020. I want to thank each of you for listening to this show, making it one of the more popular shows on the Voice America Business Channel. Also, want to encourage you to continue sending along your thoughts, whatever they may be, to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. Questions, the number four, taylor@gmail.com. I also want to thank our sponsors. Otherwise, we would not be having this show. Our sponsors that make this show available today are Eli Gold, Great Bear Resources, Hannon Metals, Irving Resources, Lion One Metals, Novo Resources, and Sitka Gold Corp. Before we get into today's show, I want to inform you that I did an interview with Dr. Quentin Henning yesterday concerning the urgency of self-quarantining yourself and with plenty of food and water to last at least the next several weeks. Dr. Henning also discussed how the coronavirus is impacting the way he is handling and advising companies that he has some responsibility for, such as Novo Resources, Irving Resources, and Lion One Metals. All three of which, of course, are sponsors of this show and are among my favorite companies in my newsletter and in my personal account, for that matter. You can listen to this interview with Dr. Henning by going to Jay Taylor Media, J-A-Y Taylor Media, or you can go to my YouTube channel as well. I've titled today's show, Why Are Things Falling Apart? Charles Hugh Smith will be with me in the second half of today's show. Michael Oliver will be with me momentarily. And Michael Hudson appears for the first time to talk about a massive new sedimentary-hosted copper-silver discovery in Peru. Mainstream pundits on CNBC and Fox Business channels have been talking about what a great economy Americans have enjoyed, with stocks hitting new highs month after month. But quite abruptly, a black swan named coronavirus swam into the economy, triggering enormous equity market declines and, without a doubt, untold carnage in the real economy. The response is already a promise of trillions of newly printed dollars to try to alleviate the pain of this suffering, whether or not that pain is the suffering of common folks or, most importantly, the big boys on Wall Street remains to be seen. Well, most people will say that, as they did after 2000 or the 1987 crashes, that no one could see it coming. But that's not exactly true. There have always been those who understand Austrian economics that realize that the seeds of our ultimate monetary destruction were sown by John Maynard Keynes, who introduced the economic religion of Keynesianism. In fairness to Keynes, his theories held that government should pay back debt in good times and only go into deficits during business downturns. Unfortunately, unlike truly free market economics built on solid foundations of an honest monetary system like gold or silver, being a faith-based economic system like Keynesianism is, there was no way of enforcing good behavior. So the natural laws of economics, when based on sound money, they do enforce responsible behavior in the best interest of people. They obey the laws of natural economics. But not so with Keynesian economics. The politicians have never been able to pay back during good times. They've always been borrowing more and more, and the consequence has been mountains of debt that is really now starting to bog down, more than bog down, to destroy the global economy, in essence. And we're starting to see that in spades once again. They managed to right the aircraft in 2008, but at great expense, and now I'm afraid you know, the as they say, the we're about to pay for the sins of our past, it would seem. So while it may not be true that you can't predict which black swan will trigger what which problem and when, there are people who have studied and understand deeper underlying social problems and economic problems. Charles Hugh Smith, who wrote the book Why Things Are Falling Apart, will be with me in the second half of today's show to talk about that and more directly and more immediately the concerns of the moment, the coronavirus. And so we'll ask Charles to dive deeper into the underlying self-inflicted pathology of the Western world and to try to get a better understanding of why things are falling apart. More importantly, what we can do right now to help ourselves and to protect our families. Michael Hudson, as I mentioned, will be with me to talk right after our first commercial break, actually, about what is really looking like a massive high-grade copper-silver sedimentary hosted deposit in Peru. And that company is Hannon Metals that he heads up. So he'll be here to tell us about that in the second segment of today's show. But right now, I'm really happy to tell you that Michael Oliver is with me. Thanks for joining me, Michael.
Hi, Jay. Good to be back. Interesting times.
Oh, my goodness. Interesting times. And you don't know how much I wish we had had you last week, but we've got you now. So in a note to me earlier today, you talked about a broad slingshot move for the commodity sector in general. And I'm bringing this up now because my next guest is Michael, is going to be, I'm going to have my guest from Hannon, Michael Hudson. He's going to be with me to talk about this copper and silver deposit. Well, silver is really, it's just getting slammed. Copper is no big winner either this year so far. And yet you're suggesting that we may be on to or about to see a major move in the broad commodity sector. Now, I know you've been saying this, and you've been particularly bullish on the soft commodities to a great extent, but talk to us about your latest views on the commodity sector in general at a time when, you know, when people are selling whatever they're able to sell, it seems, in order to pay back the margin clerk.
Mm-hmm. In the weekend report, we had I put up some simple price charts. Normally, we show momentum in price, but the price charts are so evident, that, and they contradict basic notions that investors have right now. And that is that when the stock market goes down, the commodity's going down too. Well, on a short-term basis, yes, they have been. Copper especially, crude oil especially, and silver recently. The gold miners broke last week and basically exploded since then. But when you stand back and go back to 2008, go back 11, 12 years, and look at a monthly price chart of the Bloomberg Commodity Index, crude oil, copper, silver, XAU index of the gold miners, and then put in contrast the S&P price chart going back to 2008 and 9, they're totally opposite. S&P has been driving from the lower left hand of the page to the upper right hand for 11 years. And the commodity complex in waves has been in a downward angle since 2008, with a secondary peak in 2011, but in a major downward zigzag angle. However, in 2016, when gold bottomed, when silver made a low, crude oil made a low at $26, which we're challenging right now, Bloomberg made a low, Bloomberg Commodity Index, everything made a low in 2016. And basically, since 2016, most commodities have done what? Go sideways.
Uh-huh.
In a broad range, but go sideways. Gold's the exception to that. You can almost like a box to the right. And now silver nipped out its low by a dollar this week. Crude oil may take out its $26 low that it made in early 2016, but these are likely to be fake-out new lows, unsustainable. Commodities in general are fully smashed. They're theoretical zero, in my view. They were there in 2016. They're still there. They're not going to go substantially lower. This is a base. And I think the central banks are creating the, have lit the fuse to ignite this base. The triggering factors will be investors. If in, to the extent investors are a bit tired or suspicious of stocks, and they now should be, they need to put their money somewhere. Well, when you look at the commodity charts, yes, they're under pressure right now, but they're at the bottom end of these theoretical zero price bases. Oil's not going to zero. You know, $26, compare that to its high in 2008, $147. or its high even several months ago, you know, at 77. This is a very low prices for commodities. So the argument that, oh, demand is weakening, et cetera, yeah, that's already reflected in the price action.
Mm-hmm.
So what we see at Momentum Structural Analysis is major basis with pending triggers overhead for most of these markets. Some of them will be stronger than others. But the percent gain that you can see out of some of these markets, given the price levels they're at now and the fact that they're oversold and the fact that they're exhausted on the downside, you could have vacuum-type upturns, much like we just saw, which we expected in the GDX ETF. It dropped down to $16 and change on Friday. I was watching the ticks, a five-minute bar chart. It was a full crash mode trying to copy the stock market. Where is it trading now? Reached 25 today.
Mm-hmm.
From 16 to 25 in a matter of a few days.
Yeah.
Well, it shouldn't have been down there at 16. That was a fake out. It didn't make a new low, by the way. Its low in 2016 was $12.40. So GDX came back, probed near that low, took out a few intervening lows to run some stops. But as soon as they did, the vacuum effect took hold. We're now closer to the top of the range than the bottom of the range in a matter of 48 hours. That's the kind of action we're tending to expect. Other market we're watching very closely in that regard is silver. Silver tapped out its 2016 low by a dollar or so. It was $13 and change back then. We got to just under 12 in this recent break. It's now trading around 13. We're watching for trigger numbers on that market, and we'll update our subscribers accordingly. Gold, meanwhile, is what? We've had a big up day in the dollar because there's a panic run for dollars around the world as the financial markets are, in, you know, quite unstable and fractured. The Fed is noticing that. They're providing trillions of liquidity around the world. They're buying T-bonds and so forth to satisfy that demand.
Right.
But the gold, the dollar is up sharply today. Gold's $100 off yesterday's low.
Mm-hmm.
So again, comparisons of what the dollar is doing versus gold, I think, are essentially irrelevant. The dollar has not been a beneficiary to gold over the last couple of years, and yet gold has gone from, what, 1100s to 1700.
Right.
So, you know, I think people have to stand back and look at this commodity complex and realize that gold is leading, as it did in the late 70s, by the way, and that most of these commodities are bombed out. And if they're bombed out and investor preference shifts, once you get an upturn in the commodities, once they can smell that upturn, the flow of new liquidity that the central banks are creating, where is it going to go? Into a stock market that's now fractured or into bottomed out commodities? I think the latter.
Well, I would suggest so, because I think you're going to see declining earnings now as we go forward. The global economy is a mess. It's coming unglued, at least for the foreseeable future. I think that's a fair statement. I think we're in a recession already. Likely we'll see as we progress through the year. They usually backdate these things. Michael, with 1 minute left, though, the dollar, as you just mentioned, has been stronger. I see this as a liquidity crunch issue that, when margins come under pressure, people have to sell whatever they're able to sell. One of the reasons I think gold stocks got smashed is people just indiscriminately sold whatever they were able, not necessarily what they wanted to sell. But how long can this dollar remain strong, quote-unquote strong?
It's strong compared to 2 weeks ago when it was trading at 94 on the dollar index. It's now at 99.90 or 100. Remember, it was 103.50 back in 2017.
Uh-huh.
So if you look at a chart going back about to 2016 and 17 and draw a line sideways, we're off the recent lows. We're still below the highs of that move.
Mm-hmm.
If you look back 20 or 30 years on the dollar, these levels are hardly high at all.
Yeah, exactly.
In fact, it doesn't even look like a bull trend. So I think the jerking around of the dollar, which is likely to flip back down again once the Fed prints enough to satisfy that need, might help gold at that point. But gold hasn't needed to help up to this to this point. In fact, if you were waiting on dollar demise over the last two years, you would have missed the entire move in gold.
You'd have missed the move, right, exactly. Yeah. All right, Michael.
My suggestion is ignore it.
Very good advice. Thank you so much, Michael, for being with us. Always good to have you for your insights, and we'll look to do it again in a couple of weeks. All right. Well, folks, we do have to go to break now. Don't go away, though, because Michael Hudson will be with us from Hannon Metals. Very exciting story there, a new discovery, major high-grade, looks like a very massive discovery of copper and silver. So don't go away. We'll be right back with Michael Hudson.
Noble Resources Corp. trades on the OTCQX under the symbol NSRPF and on the TSX Venture Exchange under the symbol NVO. Its flagship assets are located in the Pilbara region of Western Australia. Novo has recently partnered with Sumitomo Corporation of Japan to evaluate, advance, and develop the company's Australian gold projects. With over $40 million in cash and $60 million committed from Sumitomo, Novo is well on its way to establishing itself as one of the top junior explorers and developers in Australia.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I am your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm here with Michael Hudson, who is the chairman and CEO of Hannon Metals. This is the first time we've spoken to Michael, so I'm going to just give you a little bit of his background. For the past 28 years, Michael has developed mineral exploration properties. He's worked on those over the last 28 years worldwide. He has an impressive academic background in his geological studies from the University of Melbourne, and he received the Tolhurst Nobel Prize for Mining Investment Analysis in Victoria, Australia. And he started his career in 1990 with Pasminco. That's the largest global integrated zinc producer during the 1990s, and spent 10 years working with zinc lead projects worldwide, from exploration to pre-feasibility projects in Pakistan, Australia, and Peru. Michael has raised over $100 million in primarily European-focused exploration projects in Finland, Spain, Portugal, Sweden, and Ireland. Since 2004, he has headed Mawson Resources as founding chairman, CEO, and director. He is also founder and chairman of Leading Edge Materials. It's a critical metals company in Sweden and a director of Hydro 66 Holdings Corp. But today we want to talk to Michael about Hannon Metals, which has an exciting new discovery in Peru. I first heard about Hannon when interviewing Bob Moriarty on this show towards the end of 2019. Bob picked Hannon as one of his top two picks for 2020. On the basis of Bob's recommendation, I checked out his story, as the story of Hannon, and liked it very much, and agreed that it is a compelling story, putting it into my as coverage for my newsletter, Jay Taylor's Gold, Energy, and Tech Stock. So I'm really delighted to have Michael with me today. But before I say hello to Michael, I should note that this interview was pre-recorded on Monday afternoon, March 16th in New York, or Tuesday morning in Melbourne, Australia, where Michael is. At this time, the shares of Hannon were trading at around Canadian 15 cents, or around 12 cents in U.S. money. And so with 178 million shares outstanding, it gives the company a minuscule market cap of maybe around $20 million in U.S. money or something like that. So, of course, that's a minuscule market cap only if the company has something of value much more than its market cap. And I believe that is the case, which is why I'm really pleased to have Michael with me today. Thanks for joining me, Michael.
It's a pleasure, Jay. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and thanks for traveling safely. And I guess you're self-quarantining yourself quarantined down in Melbourne. Now you just went on a whirlwind trip. My goodness, how many continents, and just incredible. You were in South America. You were in Canada. You were where all were you in the last couple weeks?
It was the Amazon to Arctic field trip, punctuated by PDAC and a U.S. marketing tour through five or six of your major cities there last week. So I've been around the world, man.
Boy, you sure have, literally. And I hope that you're well and keep safe down there in these very dangerous times. Well, notwithstanding current market conditions, I know you are excited about your sediment-hosted copper-silver project down in Peru, known as the San Martin Project. Can you help our listeners understand why the excitement from your perspective as a geologist, even if the markets could care less right now?
Well, exploration is the engine room for the mining business, Jay, and the truth is that we work on big time frames. You know, we're going to mine more than copper in the next 20 years than we have on the history of the earth. So the world is desperately looking for new metals, and copper specifically because of the electrification of the world. So what we've come across in Peru is basically a new basin, a new sediment hosted copper silver basin, which is pretty rare. You know, we've searched the world pretty thoroughly over the last 100 years, and new deposits are hard to find, let alone new basin scale areas, which, you know, we've got an area staked over 120 kilometers, excuse my metric, but it's a huge area, new discovery.
Oh, it's huge, absolutely huge. Can you give us a sense then of the grades that you found? And I believe you've had over several areas of this massive discovery, you've seen outcroppings, and you've gotten some pretty high grades. Could you share those with our listeners?
Yeah, sure. The context of the mineralization is pretty well understood because we've got the data of the petroleum industry who've explored there for the last 20 or 30 years. So it's really important that these grades have great context at the same or similar stratigraphic horizons over that, you know, 100 plus kilometers. So we've been getting areas of 3 to 5 meters thickness at sort of 3 to 5% copper, wow, plus an ounce or two of silver, really, in the few outcrops that we found. We found, you know, half a dozen or so outcrops and then hundreds of boulders in creeks. But the grades are exceedingly high, and they need to be for these deposits to work. But yeah, very, very good start.
And I believe there's, you know, as I noticed on the map on your website, there are about 5 different targets, I believe, on this San Martin. How far apart are they located, and which ones might you be working on or focusing on first, and why?
Yeah, it's a really good question because we've got such a large area, and we want to make sure we're focusing in on the best areas as early as we can. So we've got a large stream sediment survey sampling program to try and nail down the better parts of the system over that 120 kilometer trend. We've walked a lot of these areas already. We did a little bit of work this year, and then we've been funded to put a much bigger team in this year, and up until a few days ago they were working there very actively, We've also found areas where there's more outcrops. The very southern area, which we call Sacanche, is the area of interest at the moment. We've inferred this rich copper horizon over a couple of kilometers through the outcrops and the like. So that's where we're putting in the most effort at the moment, and that correlates to where we're gaining social license and accessing these areas with the approval of the local landholders. So it's hand in hand, but there's no shortage of target areas, and we've got a sort of like a pyramid of work programs where we're covering large areas rapidly, and as we progress to the top of that pyramid, we're doing a lot more detailed work like soils and mapping and eventually drilling in those areas where we've got more information.
Mm-hmm. I know you mentioned up until a few days ago your people were on the site working away. Are you being held back a bit now by the coronavirus?
Yeah, this is going to affect the whole industry from supplies right down through to getting people on the ground. Peru only yesterday announced a state of emergency, and everyone in the country must self-isolate. They can only go out and buy food, medical supplies, or the banks are staying open. So that's, of course, going to affect us in the short to medium term, and no doubt we'll see how that progresses. But airports have shut down. The regional airport that has 10 or 11 flights from Lima daily over a 50-minute flight for us to get in. So it's a time for reflection and pulling together some data. But we've been working there for the last few months pretty actively. So there will be news flow and data coming through over the next month or so as all that work is compiled and assays are received.
Okay. I'm wondering, you have these outcrops. Is that true of all five of those targets that you had so far, that you've had outcrops on all five of them?
It depends on what scale we're talking about, the five areas. But really, most of the outcrops have come on that southern 20 kilometers of the trend, Jay, where we put in much more work. So that's the Kanche area. Yeah. And we're talking 20 kilometers, which is only fifth of our area. So up north, zipping 80 kilometers north, we found mainly just boulders and creeks. So we haven't had the time to basically walk up the hills to find those outcrops where those boulders are coming from. But we certainly know it's extensive. We know it's the same type of mineralization. Mm-hmm. So it's mainly in the south where we've done the work, where we've got those outcrops.
Okay, that's the Kanche area, I think is what you said. And do you have a sense of, I mean, are these flat-lying beds, sedimentary beds? And if that's the case, are they, how deep do you think they might be where it doesn't outcrop? Do you have any sense of how deep these things might be under the surface?
Yeah, it's we have an idea because we've got this petroleum data that I just briefly mentioned. Uh-huh. We've got the seismic data. So we actually have torn this basin apart, or, well, the petroleum industry did, in terms of torn it apart in terms of geological understanding. So these things are generally flat-lying, which is important because it makes them more mineable. Now, that's a big forward-looking statement because we haven't yet drilled this. This is a brand-new discovery.
Sure.
But flat-lying bodies give you the chance to, on sort of skinnier bodies, the 2 to 5 meter thick horizons, if they're flat-lying, are much more mineable than if they're vertical and costs go through the roof and it makes it harder. So that's a pleasing concept. And the other style of mineralization that we found, there's a couple of styles of mineralization, I suppose, in this basin. So I've been just talking about the thinner, higher-grade copper. Mm-hmm. But we know there's gossans, lead zinc gossans, that are peripheral to copper bearing areas that are 50 to 80 meters thick, and we're finding those over tens of kilometers also. And all grades of lead zinc that form peripherally in the analogs, and we should have a talk about the analogs around the world too, what we've got. And we know that they're going to be mineralized, and we've got some evidence they're copper mineralized as well as we move along strike. So it's just not the thin high grade. We've got basically thin high grade over this 120 kilometers. Is more than analogous to some of the big, huge deposits in the world, but also these gossans that, nobody's looked at this. This is frontier country in an area that's pretty accessible, and so that's the exciting thing. We're only limited to what we know at the moment, and we're going to find out a lot more as we progress this year and beyond.
Well, for sure. Okay, so let's talk about the analog. Can you compare what you're seeing here at this early stage with some of the great sedimentary hosted deposits around the world?
Yeah, that's the exciting thing, is that the geology is so analogous to the Kupferschiefer, which is in Poland and Germany, which has been mined literally for thousands of years, and that's one of the largest copper deposits on Earth, copper and silver deposits, and of course the other analog is the African copper belt, where a huge amount of the world's copper and cobalt comes from. Now, we've got a little bit of cobalt, but it's mainly the silver-rich end member that we're looking at. These deposits are the second most prolific form of copper on Earth after porphyries. And porphyries have been the big game changer since the 70s in the copper business, but their grades are lowering, and the amount of rock that has to be taken out to get these porphyries out of the ground is becoming bigger and bigger. So the big prize really in the copper space are these sediment hosted copper deposits, and if you can find a new basin, you're really in the nirvana world of future copper exploration.
Right. Now you just have to go start to drill them and prove that that's what you really have, and of course that's going to take some time. But what can we look forward to then? I guess it's really hard to plan your drill program because of this coronavirus, but what do you think might be accomplished this year, assuming that this thing doesn't go on too many more months?
Yeah, sure. I mean, we can only work within the boundaries of how this plays out, but our plans still stay intact, and we'll enact them again as the situation allows. But basically, we've got half a dozen geologists on the ground, four to six geologists, and we're basically doing all that sampling, which is really quite cheap, but the most first principle thing to do in any new discovery is to understand the geology and go and sample what's at surface. Equally, as I touched on before, getting or obtaining that social license from the people on the ground is critical. So we've got a social licensing team, and then employing people locally in each different provincial area, so we can message what we're doing, what we said we'd do, what we've done, and building up that credibility with the locals. And then we hope to be going towards drill permitting in some of these areas in the next 2 to 3 months, but we'll see where that goes. And that should have us drilling by the end of the year in specific areas. It's a sort of a 6-month process, we figure, but Peru's been very difficult. We know Peru well. You touched on some of my experience, and I've been there since the 90s, and I've been working with the team that's in place in Peru since those days. So we've got very experienced people and know how to operate in the country very well. But that's our best guess at the moment, Jay,
sure.
All else being
sure.
A bit uncertain.
Sure, absolutely. And there will be some more data coming through, though, before you're drilling, as you said. And so how well-funded are you, Michael? And that question, and just with another minute left, any metallurgical problems on the horizon?
That's a good question too. So, funding wise, we put about 2.2 million Canadian in the bank only a month or two ago, which was extremely well timed, no doubt. And that will allow us a $1.7 million program this year, which is, relatively substantial. And we'll find out 10 times as much about this discovery over the next 6 months if we can get back on the ground. And we've been working there for the last few months, and we've been finding a hell of a lot. Metallurgically, copper is in the form of chalcocite, which is probably the best high-grade pure copper mineral that you'd want, and the concentrates that chalcocite can do form are in demand. So that there's no red flags at the moment without a hell of a lot of metallurgical work, of course, but chalcocite is what everybody wants.
Excellent. All right, well, we really wish you the best. It is an exciting story, no doubt. We'll be keeping in touch with you, Michael, to find out how things are going, both for my newsletter as well as for the listeners of this show. I want to thank you very much for being with us today, and we'll look to update this story as things unfold. Thank you so much for being with us.
Many thanks, Jay.
All right, folks. Well, we do have to go to break now. Don't go away, though, because coming back, Charles Hugh Smith will be with us to talk about why things seem to be so crazy these days. What's going on in the markets and also with this virus? What's happening? And Charles Hugh Smith will have some insights that I think will be very helpful to you. So don't go away. We'll be right back.
Great Bear Resources, trading under GBR on the TSX and GTBDF on the OTCQX, is a gold exploration company focused on their 23-kilometer, wholly-owned Dixie project in the prolific Red Lake mining district of Ontario. Having recently made multiple high-grade gold discoveries, GBR is fully funded to complete a very active 200,000-meter drill program through to the year 2021. Stay up to date on what has been considered one of the best performing exploration stocks in the last 2 years by visiting greatbearresources.ca.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have with me once again Charles Hugh Smith. Charles is the author and proprietor of the popular blog of twominds.com, which he started in 2005, and he's a contributing editor to peakprosperity.com. He is the author of numerous books, including Why Everything is Falling Apart, An Unconventional Guide to Investing in Troubled Times. He wrote that back in 2013. He's also written several other books. One that we did talk to him about before was Money and Work Unchained, in which he addresses the idea of universal basic income. And that may be a topic that some politicians are looking at right now, in fact, given the coronavirus and the market carnage that seems to be taking place. Anyway, given his most recent equity, given the most recent equity comments, equity market meltdown, I should say, and the carnage that's coming about with this coronavirus, I want to talk to Charles maybe first and foremost right now about a recent article, March 16th article, titled COVID-19, Helicopter Money, Go Big Now or Go Home. Welcome, Charles. Thanks for joining me again.
Jay, it's always my pleasure.
It's always good to talk to you, and you are keeping yourself quite a ways away from your other home. And today, I think I'm talking to you in Hawaii. You also have a home around the Bay Area, where we were just a week ago or so for our son's wedding. But the Bay Area is getting hit pretty hard with the coronavirus. And how are things in Hawaii?
Well, so far, Jay, there's fewer cases here, but we don't know whether that's just a result of fewer tests being given, which is the issue in many places in the U.S. We don't know if the number of official cases reflects a lack of testing as opposed to an actual, limited spread of the virus.
Mm-hmm. I guess we don't know this yet, but to what extent does warm weather play in this with this virus? I mean, is it going to be less hospitable in warm environments? And I would imagine that you're living in where you are in Hawaii, the temperatures are generally higher than in the Bay Area, or not?
It tends to be in the low 80s here as opposed to the 60s and 70s. But I'm no expert, but I have read that people are looking at Australia as a test case for that theory.
Ah, sure.
Because it is summer there, and it's very hot in a lot of Australia. And we know that the epidemic has spread there. And so therefore, there's some concern that that heat is not going to suppress it as much as we hoped.
Mm-hmm. Time will tell, I guess. Yes, we can hope, but we have to be realistic as well. So I want to really, COVID-19, helicopter money, go big now or go home. You wrote in that article, governments around the world will be forced to distribute helicopter money to keep people fed and housed and their economies from imploding. Do you see that unwinding now? I mean, I'm seeing some talk about $1,000 checks or something like that from the Trump administration. That's like $330 billion, roughly, I think, if you give $1,000 to every American. But in the meantime, I know the Fed's been pumping in trillions of dollars in the repo market, and they just committed another $1.5 trillion, I think, last week to try to stabilize the markets. They've cut the rates down to zero. Nothing seems to be working, but do you see any signs at all that that they're going to do anything on behalf of the masses of people, or is it going to be same old, where Wall Street gets bailed out, the ruling elite are taken care of, but the common folks are left trailing behind?
Well, Jay, that's a very good description of what my fear is, and the hopeful part of that statement is, I think we're in a different environment than we were in 2008, which was a which was a financial crisis as opposed to a healthcare crisis, an economic crisis, a crisis in the real world economy. And so one thing I'm hesitant about, a lot of the commentary I read out there, is people try to compare the current situation to 1929, you know, the Great Depression, yeah, or the 2000 dot-com meltdown, or the 2008 subprime global financial crisis. All of those were fundamentally financial crises caused by too much leverage, too much debt, too much speculation, right? Now, we have that exact same setup, which is why we're seeing these huge dislocations in markets around the world. Is there was too much leverage, too much debt, and too much speculation, right? And so that's the perfect setup for a financial dislocation or crisis. But beyond that, this is not just a financial crisis where the Fed can, you know, provide short-term lending and kind of smooth everything over. This is a healthcare crisis, and this is a crisis in the real-world economy, which is why I wanted to talk about helicopter money. Is many of us already know waiters, waitresses, wait staff, people in the tourist industry who were already laid off, right? Mm-hmm. Even before the lockdown, their hours were being slashed, and I have a deep concern for small businesses, having been, you know, self-employed or in small business myself for decades. It's like the carnage in the small business sector is going to be huge, and just giving people $1,000 isn't going to bail out all the small businesses, many of whom face really high rents. You know, that's another issue I wanted to mention here, is the cost structure of American life has gone up so much that utilities, fees, taxes, rent, it's like incredibly expensive to have a bricks and mortar business. And so I don't think $1,000 per household or per adult is going to really fix the problem for small business. That's one of my concerns.
And I don't know how much that does for, as you point out, just the general living expense. You know, what does $1,000 do in the Bay Area, for example, to pay for your rent? Not much, or in New York City for that matter. Never mind food. How concerned are you about the this supply disruptions of food? I mean, Quentin Henning was making the point that in New York City here, we may have some issues of even seeing our groceries stocked. Certainly, there, you know, the long-lasting food items have disappeared from the shelves in a couple of days here. But in a, if you had a total lockdown, you might not see trucks coming over the George Washington Bridge to deliver food and so forth. Do you see that as a potential problem?
Well, it's something that we're all monitoring. I think America is blessed in terms of food with a pretty diverse supply chain. Other nations are much more dependent on food from elsewhere. You know, we grow most of our own food, and most of the stuff that's imported is specialty items. And we have a pretty diverse supply chain, you know, of hundreds of, you know, independent trucking companies and railways and so on. So I think we're going to be okay. There may be shortages in some items, but I think it's definitely an issue in other countries which are dependent on global supply chains for their food, and also disruptions that are deeper than the ones we're experiencing. For instance, I saw, this is anecdotal, this was just a report from someone in Thailand who had friends in China, so this is not an official media report I read, but this person was reporting that in rural cities in China, there was a huge stench from all the farm animals who had died for lack of feed and care.
Yeah.
In other words, when you know, when you abandon your farms or you're too sick to take care of your animals, then then you can have. So other countries might be experiencing a decline in food production that's going to show up in their economies in a few months.
You wrote in that article that the pandemic crisis isn't going to end in April or May, though the urge to indulge in such magical thinking is powerful. It might still be expanding in August and September. That rings true based on a discussion I had with Dr. Quentin Henning, who I interviewed. That interview can be heard at J. Taylor Media. But Dr. Henning pointed out that, time is of the essence. And unless people start quarantining themselves, unless you have mass quarantinings sooner rather than later, because of the exponential growth of this virus, one day adds something like 40% to the number of infections. Is this what you're seeing, that we're not acting soon enough, and that is why this thing could drag on well into the summer and even beyond, or what?
Yeah, I am deeply concerned, and as your interview pointed out, this thing takes off really quickly, and we can look at Italy as the best documented example. The first severe case of the coronavirus occurred in Italy on February 20th, uh-huh. And within 3 weeks, there were thousands of cases, and they locked the country down. Only 3 weeks, that's all it took. Mm-hmm. And so that is what's different about this from the normal flu or whatever, right? I mean, this thing advances extremely quickly. I think part of my concern is about it stretching out is I think it's now endemic in much of the world, meaning that there's no way to eradicate it. And so there's a pool of people, of asymptomatic people, people that had mild mm-hmm. symptoms or don't even have any symptoms at all, that are going to still be out there. And so when they release these lockdowns and reduce the limitations on movement and enterprise, commerce, then this pool of people will re-enter the mainstream, and then there'll be a new wave of infections. And this, we also have to be concerned, and again, I'm not an expert, I'm simply mm-hmm. referring to other experts that mm-hmm. say that, viruses mutate very quickly. And so we're all kind of assuming that there's not going to be a mutation that takes a turn for the worse, like, for instance, increases the danger to young people, or that it doesn't become even more contagious. Those are unknowns. But I think the economic damage is already so severe.
Oh my goodness!
That we're looking at effects into August, September, October. Even if the coronavirus itself was magically disappeared in a few weeks.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can't imagine. I mean, I think that the global economy was slowing down a bit anyway, and we've had 10 years of growth here in the U.S., tepid as it may have been, but the equity markets, of course, growing, I think, relatively higher even than the real economy. And so the redistribution of wealth to the top one half of 1% or 1% has been very profound. And, of course, a lot of our politics has evolved around that realization that there's just extreme redistribution of wealth. When you say it's imperative to go big now, so you're talking mostly, I guess, from an economic point of view. Do you see revolutions, or you see uprisings among the people? I mean, when people become destitute and they have nothing to lose, isn't that when you start to have real problems in terms of civil disorder?
Exactly, Jay. You said it very concisely, and one of my favorite examples of that is in the French Revolution, the mobs arose and tore down the Bastille, which is considered by many people sort of the start of the uprising, on the day that the price of bread skyrocketed in Paris to the point where people could not afford to eat. Then, uh-huh. as you said, that's what triggers social disorder. I hope and pray that doesn't occur in around the world, but it's certainly the trigger when you feel that you cannot afford to eat or pay your utilities or your rent, then you are pushed to extremes. And unfortunately, here in the U.S., I'm going to just step back for a minute and try to provide some context. Over the last 20 years since the mm-hmm. dot-com bubble burst, we've seen I think we've seen an erosion in investment in productivity. And mm-hmm. and you and I have discussed this in previous mm-hmm. shows, that the real source of wealth is greater productivity that mm-hmm. is distributed throughout the economy. And of course, this is what the dot-com bubble was based on, was, my gosh, look at all these tools that are going to increase our productivity.
Yeah.
And so we've underinvested in that kind of thing. I know that you can look at, there's certainly many examples of greater productivity tools being made available. But as a general rule, what's happened is we've invested in stock buybacks and and this kind of unproductive stuff. And that created asset bubbles that gave us the illusion of greater wealth, but it wasn't really creating an engine of greater wealth. And then, as you said, because it wasn't really widely distributed productivity gains, it was simply asset bubbles and speculative ventures, well, then that all flows to the people that have the capital and that can borrow it at very low cost, right? So that's why we've got this huge wealth disparities. And now those bubbles are bursting and all assets are going to be repriced.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems so. And, you know, and the common folks are really being left behind once again in a major way. I guess the question is, do you see real prospects then if trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars are spent or created out of nothing? It would seem as though we're going to be facing an inflationary problem of some kind, which unless there's lots of money distributed to the common folks, trillions and trillions of dollars, we're pumping money into Wall Street. I mean, this $1.5 trillion just last week was committed by the Fed. As I said, huge amounts of money that have been pumped in to the markets to try to keep things going the last several months, since September of last year. Do you believe that we have a real potential hyperinflation problem a la the French Revolution? Is that a possibility here? Do you see that at all?
I'm not sure we're going to reach hyperinflation, but I do think it's highly likely that we're going to see inflation kick up for the same reason you said. You pump in trillions into the Wall Street to try to prop it up. That's one thing. But if we do helicopter money, we're not creating the goods and services, but we're creating the money. And so therefore, the larger sum of money is going to be chasing what goods and services are still out there. And that's where you get in inflation. And of course, you and I have also discussed this in the past, that real world inflation is much higher than the official rate, right? We've all of us who buy health insurance on our own, we've been hit with, 10-15% increases year after year after year. So when we're told the official inflation rate is 2%, we can only laugh rather bitterly. So we've already had a lot of inflation in the real world. And so another dose of it could really push a lot of people into insolvency, because they really just – they can barely afford – living standards right now.
Yeah, it's no question about it. So you have this massive amount of money that's being created, and I think though that if it goes into the hands of individuals, as you say, that will create enormous demand for goods and services without putting. But again, this gets back to your idea of a lack of increase in productivity, where cheap money is available for companies to borrow and buy their stock back. Of course, right now, with things going the way they are around the world, I can't imagine, all the big airlines, for example, all that, hundreds of billions of dollars, probably billions of dollars at least a day, flowing into the banking system is no longer going in there. The illiquidity in the banking system, I can't imagine, Charles, that the ruling elite and the bankers won't be fighting like heck to try to stay alive, and they could care less about the common folks. But again, this gets to this idea: when people are desperate, and we've already seen the yellow jackets in France, for example, right? And things haven't. I mean, this was before the outbreak, so there's a lot of reasons to be very concerned about this. Well, I guess we can wring our hands, but we need hope. And so give us some of that if you can, Charles. What should we be doing and what do we need to do to literally to stay alive here going forward?
Right. Well, I have a couple of comments on that, Jay. One is, of course, if you have cash, or if you can liquidate assets at and get out with a little profit and have cash for the repricing of assets, there's going to be some bargains in things like maybe agricultural agricultural commodities, maybe mm-hmm. oil. Mm-hmm. A lot of things may go on sale here as the speculators have to sell everything, mm-hmm. you know. So that's one opportunity. The other thing is, I think it could end up being good for the economy in terms of it finally increasing productivity. Like, for instance, a lot of colleges are closing and mm-hmm. the students have to go online. Mm-hmm. Well, guess what? That works for probably 80% of all college students. So why the heck do we have to charge people $30,000 a year to stay on a campus when actually you can cover 80% of your education online?
Yeah. Interesting.
So we should be able to see some gains there. And what about working from home? Everybody that works in front of a screen, if they can work at home, that's a lot less commuter hours mm-hmm. wasted, a lot yep. of fuel that isn't wasted. So mm-hmm. I see some gains from the adjustments we're making, you know, if we can institute them.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly your idea about commodity prices, that coincides very well with the views of Michael Oliver, who is with us during the first segment of today's show. His view is that we are poised for major gains in the commodities, and I suppose if there's inflation, that would be maybe part of the reason for it. Commodities going up. Well, just with a couple of minutes left here, my engineer says 2 minutes, in fact. Just talk to us a little bit about why things are falling apart. In general, you know, I mean, the Austrians, people of my ilk, a lot of times like to just look at money, the debasement of currency. And you mentioned about how we're spending our money badly and not building capital and productivity. But just quickly, maybe just summarize your article or your book, Why Things Are Falling Apart.
Okay. Thanks, Jay, for that question. Basically, what I was trying to explain is why our system has become vulnerable to shocks and why it's so fragile. And it's fragile, first off, financially, as you say, in terms of our money. And it's financially, it's economically fragile because we're not investing and costs have risen and wages are stagnant. But it's also socially fragile for the reasons that we already discussed, that as you undermine the real world economy that 95% of us live in, you create these social instabilities. And then politically, as we all know, you know, the wealthy and the lobbyists control, you know, Washington. And so we're also created a fragility in our political system, that it's no longer functioning. You know, it's not really taking care of or addressing the problems we actually have. It's just putting on window dressing and bailing out, you know, Wall Street, and that's mm-hmm. not really solving the problem. So all of these fragilities mm-hmm. are, you know, they're now becoming visible with the coronavirus.
Right. All right. We'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much, Charles, for being with us again. It's really great to talk with you. I hope we can have you back soon again. Why Things Are Falling Apart, folks, if you want a more conclusive answer, you might want to consider buying the book published in 2013. I guess it's still available, Charles, right?
Online? Yes, it is.
All right,
yes.
Folks, we'll have to leave it go at that. That's all the time we have for this week. Next week, Alistair McLeod will be with me, John Rubino as well. Until then, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
Lion One Metals, one of 2019's top performing gold stocks, is geared for aggressive growth in 2020. With drilling underway at its fully permitted high-grade Tuvatu gold project in Fiji, one of the last high-grade gold deposits of its kind anywhere in the world, not owned by a major gold mining company, Lion One trades in the USA on the OTCQX under the symbol LOMLF and in Canada under LIO on the TSXV. To learn more about Lion One's world-class high-grade gold potential in Fiji, go to liononemetals.com.